Hello, this is the Surviving Healthcare Podcast, and I have Katrina Lewis here, and she is another physician who has an incredible background, a lot of training, and she has had this journey to save herself from breast cancer, and she's going to describe all the treatments and all her experiences along the way. And Katrina, welcome, and tell us a little bit about your background first.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Yoho. Robert. Yes, thank you. I'm honored to be on your podcast. You're doing wonderful work.
I'm a very important animal.
You're a cog in the wheel.
I'm a cog in the wheel.
You're the cog in the wheel of helping humanity. So,
I hope so.
Yeah, you know, before I launch into talking about me, you know, I always say it's like if modern medicine were so wonderful. It's interesting that there isn't almost a healthy human being left on the planet, except people who live far away from so-called modern Western medicine, right?
That's exactly
Especially
right.
In America. So, yeah. But anyway, I grew up in South Africa originally. My mother was a physician, and my dad was an industrial psychologist, but he was a pharmaceutical rep for a while. Isn't that ironic? Excuse me. And I went to medical school when I was 16. I was on a scholarship. So after medical school, I worked off a year or so of that scholarship because doing all kinds of things, tuberculosis clinics and just general community health stuff, because it was through the Cape Town City Council. But then I went on to get diplomas in emergency medicine. And in medical school, I actually did two degrees by the time I graduated at the age of 22, 23. What I did was I started my first, it was something they allowed at that time. I started 3 years of medical school, and then they allowed certain select students to take a research degree year. And I spent that year getting a Bachelor of Science in Immunology and Physiological Chemistry and did a thesis on monoclonal antibodies. I made a monoclonal antibody in the lab, but I wasn't keen on research work. I love animals and I don't like hurting them or taking blood from them or doing anything on animals. So it wasn't for me, but actually, especially the immunology part of that degree, I think was seminal in making me believe in just something above ourselves, a higher power. And I'm not talking religion, I'm just talking spirituality. And I'm talking about a real understanding of how complex our bodies are in terms of their healing mechanisms. And certainly the immune system is one of the most complex. And then I graduated with my MD at the end of, they call it something different in South Africa. They followed the British MBCHB, you know, Master of and Bachelor of Medicine and Surgery. But it's an MD equivalent. And I got a degree in emergency medicine. I spent a couple of years doing emergency medicine. Then I started a surgical residency thinking I would become a surgeon. I was very interested in plastic surgery and also hand surgery because of the fine work. But because of a number of reasons, and because I was able to work in England, I decided to take almost a sabbatical year. And I went to England and I was doing emergency medicine and surgical locum work. So I didn't complete the full surgical residency in South Africa, but it certainly gave me surgical skills and a lot of understanding of surgery. And then I was offered by my locum agency to go and possibly do a few years as a cruise ship doctor, as a love boat doctor, of all things. And that was fascinating because I was on a cruise line that actually has state-of-the-art medical centers, even better than QE2, Princess and P&O Cruises. I mean, we could get blood transfusions, we could cross-match, we could do all the blood work, we could do x-rays, we could do dental work here. You know, it was like a super charged urgent care in the US, right? And so I did that for quite a few years, but obviously after a period decided I didn't want to be a cruise ship doctor for the rest of my life and came to the US, did all of my qualifications. Did in the interim, though, while I was on the cruise ships, I got a degree in clinical nutrition through the American Academy of Clinical Nutrition, because I'd already started all those years ago in my 20s developing an interest in holistic and naturopathic medicine because it made total sense to me. And then I got my board certification in anesthesiology. I went and did a fellowship training in pain medicine as a subspecialty, primarily interventional pain medicine. But again, my approach to chronic pain, and we could do that as another whole podcast, because I'm so in disagreement with much of what they put out there about chronic pain. It's like cancer. It's not one entity. There's so many different cancers. There's so many variability on so many levels. To just talk about chronic pain as a single entity and say, well, narcotics are bad or narcotics are good, it's just absolute nonsense. And then, again, there are a lot of charlatans in that field saying, oh, you know, it's just injections and radio frequencies and all these things that will cure chronic pain. And of course, that's not the answer. There's so many approaches. So that was where I really came into my own cancer journey, with that kind of paradigm, realizing that Western medicine approaches to chronic pain were not correct. So I did the fellowship in Massachusetts in pain medicine, and within a year decided to just focus on acute and chronic pain because I found it so interesting, and it segued with everything that I had done in my previous medical career. And I just kind of found anesthesia a bit boring, to be honest. And I liked the patient connection. I didn't like the fact that no matter how good an anesthetic I did for a patient, they wouldn't be any the wiser. And they wake up and they don't remember you anyway. So I've always been big on the human connection. And I really wanted to make a difference in people's quality of life. And again, in terms of the cancer paradigm and so much of what Western medicine does, the radiation and chemo, they realize patients are vulnerable and desperate to live. But what is a life without the quality? And I've seen too many patients and too many personal friends die from chemotherapy in misery. Whereas if they just either tried some different approaches, or even had done nothing at all, but didn't do the chemo, they would have probably lived just as long and probably longer. You and I know that.
Well, because, you know, my listeners have heard me say this before, but chemotherapy has only been demonstrated to improve lifespan in four or five, maybe six entities. The rest of it is completely useless in terms of the most important metric, which is how long you live. And radiation, it doesn't even have it has a single disease that it improves lifespan. That's it. It shouldn't, the whole thing is a fraud from start to finish, as far as I can tell from the outside.
Absolutely. And in my chronic pain specialty, I saw numerous patients who had severe neuropathy from chemo.
Their bodies are ruined patients by chemo and radiation.
And the radiation, severe pain on their chest wall, for instance, the breast cancer patient, from the radiation. And what is so interesting in almost all these cases, the oncologists abandon them. The minute something starts going wrong, they've made their money. The hospitals have made their money. The pharmaceutical companies have made their money. And then the patient is abandoned. Go to hospice or go to a chronic pain specialist. And that was why also during the course of my career as a chronic pain specialist, I went and did a degree in functional medicine through the A4M, the American Academy.
Describe what functional medicine is.
Functional medicine is very similar to naturopathic. So, for instance, in Florida, they don't recognize ND degrees, but naturopaths like Deepak Chopra, he's one of the most famous, or Andrew Weil, they go through a rigorous medical training, medical school, very similar to MDs, but they just approach it from a very different aspect. So they're able to prescribe antibiotics when needed. I mean, obviously, there's a need for pharmaceuticals in certain instances. So they're able to do all of that, but they look at other causes. And functional medicine is really just a different approach. There's different functional medicine. A lot of the people in functional medicine have been previous NDs or MDs, or come from or chiropractors or whatever, and they go and do these extra degrees. And obviously, again, like so much in America, you have to be careful. You can get, say, you have a functional medicine degree or a degree in pain medicine, but it depends who you got it through, right? And so,
Some of the chiropractors are very well trained. I mean, it's not universal, but they know a lot that the regular MDs have no clue about, and they just shake their heads about what the MDs are up to in a lot of cases. The other ones are
exactly.
just backcrackers who are in it just to make the money. They don't care about the rest of it. But
Yes, they've been to courses
yeah.
teaching them more about sales than anything else. Oh, sell
Exactly.
your patient a package of 20 chiropractic treatments. And I can tell you this from my experience as a chronic pain physician and really having a deep understanding of physical modalities. Most pain doctors don't understand the role of myofascial pain, which has to do with muscles, tendons, and the fascia, which is a huge pain generator. But so much of whether I sent to acupuncture, physical therapy, chiropractic, Pilates, I don't care what physical modality you talk about, I say to patients, within at least three sessions, and hopefully even in the first, you need to see ongoing improvement. And if you have not seen any long-lasting improvement within six sessions, stop. Because either it's the wrong modality for you, or you have the wrong diagnosis, or it's just not going to work at all. We need to do something totally different. So, and that's why I'm very against any kind of modality, whether it's certain drugs, whatever, the chiropractic, physical therapy, neuromuscular. You need to have set goals and parameters. It's the same as when I was treating. I mean, I'm what's called an opioid moderate, right? I'm not totally against narcotics. There's absolutely a place, but
Sorry,
I'm
you're
also
talking
not
to
a
an
huge
opioid
prescriber.
radical. You're speaking to an opioid radical.
I learned a lot, and I've become more humble the more I learn about medicine. So I think there's a place for it, because I've seen half and a hydrocodone in elderly patients make a huge difference, again, to the quality of life. And sometimes they have no other options. So what I'm saying to you is that with prescribing of drugs, and this is why the whole opioid thing is nonsense in terms of what the government is doing and big pharma, to say that everybody's the same when people have different cytochrome P450 enzyme systems in their liver. And we know that there are genetic mutations. I actually did a lot of lecturing at different conferences. I lectured on genetic testing for cytochrome P450 mutations, which determine how certain people respond to different medications. It's why often Asian people have very bad reactions to a lot of pharmaceuticals
It's
and things
Katrina
like
is
this.
just
So
describing essentially the breakdown system for these drugs. Is that correct?
that is correct.
So that's what the cytochrome P450, and if they can't break it down, they're stuck with it for long periods, or they'll have larger effects and stuff like that. So anyway,
Exactly,
that's
you get
the
drug,
English
and it's
translation.
where, right, it's where you get all these drug interactions, where in the American population in particular, because I've worked all over the world, I've never seen the amount of prescribing as what you see in America. But
we have nursing homes data. That average 20 drugs per patient. It's crazy. They're like farms, pharmaceutical company farms to sell that garbage and get it paid for by Medicare. It's just crazy.
Well, you know, what's interesting is, so it's like doctors in America have forgotten just basic training. And I was very fortunate in South Africa. We were taught you make 80% of your diagnoses with a good history. Doctors don't listen to patients anymore. And then you actually lay hands on a patient and examine them, which seldom occurs. I've been to an oncologist who didn't even examine me in the first visit. I've had chronic pain patients who say, you're the first doctor that's actually examined me in 5 years. But the other thing is, there's data showing that if you put three drugs together, your risk of drug-drug interactions, so put aside the cytochrome P450 interactions, if you have genetic mutations that make you either what's called a rapid metabolizer, where you chew up drugs and they don't work, or you're a slow metabolizer, where drugs hang around in your system forever and cause all sorts of problems and build up to toxic levels quickly, you've then got also drug-drug interactions. So with three medications, your risk of drug-drug interactions are about 30%. Once you get to five or more medications, your risk of a drug-drug interaction is about 90%, 80 to 90%. So what's that telling you is that then you start getting side effects from the drug-drug interaction. One drug is either blocking another drug or the drug's not working at all. So then what does the doctor do when you get a side effect?
Add another drug. The drugs are never studied in combination. Just isn't done. Let me just back up 1 second to the hands-on thing. It goes both ways, right? The patient, you learn something to help the patient, and the patient gets a sense of confidence or human connection or whatever it is, a huge, huge result from the hands-on. And if you don't do that, you're listening to all the idiocy about fearing sexual accusations and all that other stuff, and you're missing the major tool we have in dealing with people.
Well, and it goes to what you talk about, corruption in healthcare, because that extends to electronic health records and the paradigm that they've adopted from the Toyota factory model, which all these hospital administrators with their fancy MBAs think they know everything. They have no medical training. They think that human beings are like cars on a production line. And they actually pay doctors and incentivize physicians on these productivity contracts, which are the most immoral and unethical things ever introduced into America, ever. And I don't know how doctors adopted it. I think it started with introduction of the term provider.
Yeah.
We don't talk about legal providers or engineering providers, all these, but it's what the term came into being through the Nazis. They knew that Jewish doctors were highly respected in their communities, and they wanted to take away that respect. So they started calling them providers. And it's no denigration towards nurse practitioners, physician assistants, nurses of all kinds, other people in the health field. They're all amazing, amazing people. But to call us all providers and not by our specific specialty per se is insulting. And what it's done is give the hospital administrators the power. And then they're paying physicians and PAs and nurse practitioners to see as many patients as possible and reimbursing them on that basis and incentivizing them. And you cannot do that. You can see, as you know, as a physician, you can see two patients with exactly the same problem. One patient will take you 5 minutes. The other patient might take you an hour because you are looking at so many variables and so many different things. And if you are a physician, and we all know the boot camp / traumatic experience that we went through of residency and all those years of training, and then not just residency, medical school, then the residencies, then often the subspecializations, which And we're forced often to do research degrees and different things as part of that. You just come at it from a very different perspective. And that's why I come and have come to look at medicine and cancer and so many things that I've done in my life from more of a global perspective. I'm not just a one-trick pony. Oh, I just did pain medicine, or I just did anesthesia, or I just did this. And unfortunately, that's what you see in America, particularly, where doctors kind of confine themselves to a narrow lane, unless they're curious and they read on other things. But I, having done the emergency medicine and community clinics and mission work and things like this in South Africa, and then worked in England in the NHS system, and then worked on a cruise ship, I've done so many things. And I'm not saying that everybody should do something like that. I'm just saying that it's given me a very different, more global and more understanding perspective and more humility. And I think that that's what's needed with so many people in the medical profession, is some humility to realize you'll never know everything. And for people to say, this is the way you treat cancer, or this is the way you treat diabetes, and there's only one way, doesn't make sense, actually, because science is always evolving. And this is where censorship in America and around the world has been horrifying. Do people not realize that some of the biggest scientific breakthroughs were physicians questioning the so-called consensus and established science? You know, like the germ theory, the physician who questioned germs in all the postpartum sepsis because these obstetricians were delivering babies and not washing their hands. And it applies to so many things in medicine.
He was hounded to his death.
He was.
So
why
don't you go over the last phase of your career, what you did with that before you launch into your cancer story and your treatments, sure, and all your sophistication about that?
So the last phase of my career, as I said, I elected to stay in the chronic pain realm. I did treat some acute pain as well, but it gave me such a beautiful perspective because chronic pain specialists literally treat patients from every specialty, cancer, rheumatoid type thing, autoimmune. You see patients from the neurological sphere. You see patients who've had surgeries that have resulted in chronic pain. Obviously, you see a lot of chronic spine pain, the whole gamut. I even had some pediatric cases too. So it's just a fascinating career. But obviously, I was diagnosed with my initial stage 2 cancer, breast cancer, which I believe was from me tucking my cell phone into my bra strap, which was stupid because I used to wear
dresses. So you told me it was upper inner quadrant of your breast. Is that correct? Because that's correct. A very typical cell phone. And that's a very rare cancer to be seen in non-cell phone breast cancer. I mean,
and there's
from
not
what
a
I understand.
Single member of my family that has breast cancer. And that's one of the other points I was going to make in the podcast, is doctors in the pharmaceutical industry constantly harp about genetics. And then they make up diseases like this pharmaceutical company that now has a drug that costs $5 million a dose. Obviously,
come on. No, I don't believe that.
No, it is. I'm not kidding. It's for metachromatic leukodystrophy, which they claim is a genetic disease. And there's only about 40 patients in the US. Well, guess what? If you look at the symptoms of this disease, it's essentially a demyelinating disease. In other words, it's destroying
MS.
Nerves and things. It's all of those, MS, Parkinson's, autism. You name any of these neurological diseases, that's probably going to get us banned by me saying that. Sorry, cut that out. But I'm just saying, your skin and your neurological system is probably your canary in the coal mine in terms of being some of the first systems that are most sensitive to toxins. And so when there's a disease that's like that, then they give it a fancy name, then they can develop a fancy drug. And it's the same we're seeing now in a lot of spheres, including cancer care. Oh, we've got a genetic therapy for this because it's all your genetics. It has absolutely nothing to do with the toxins, the GMO food,
So
all these
what
different things
Katrina
we're
is
being
saying, what
bombarded with.
Dr. Katrina is saying is that the naturopaths, the functional doctors, they look at the host rather than the disease, and they think, how can they improve that immunity, and how can they make you the person stronger so they can beat the disease themselves?
Correct. And that's where what we'll discuss in a sec when I just finish what you asked me about in terms of my career. It goes to terrain. It goes to looking at everything, holistic approach to health. So anyway, after I had that diagnosis, and the only reason that I was stage two, I had a well-defined, it was about a 2 centimeter lump. But it had stayed that way for months and it had probably been developing for quite a while.
So define the cancer stages for us.
I'm not an oncologist. I'm not going to go through it, but I think there's a certain
Well, stage
slide.
four is Mets. Stage one is localized. Stage two must
Very
be with a
localized. Stage two
lymph
is
node or
with
something.
lymph node
Yeah.
involvement.
And then stage three is something or other.
I think stage three is more local extension, like into the skin around the breast.
Right.
But I think it's different for every cancer how they define stage three. But stage four is where it's spread beyond the originating cancer. And so in my case, it spread to my lungs and caused pleural effusions.
What date was your original diagnosis?
2016.
So
So
you've survived how many years now? I mean, it's like 6, 7 years, and you look great. You don't look like you've lost any weight or had any problems.
I was only diagnosed with stage four in 2022. So the way it went was 2016, I had this well-defined lump. And if I had to go back in time, I would immediately have gone and done cryotherapy because the cold freezing the cancer, it doesn't break the capsule, it destroys it locally, and it's not affecting your immune system and all of that. But of course, even though I had this naturopathic background, when I waited a while thinking, oh, it's nothing, it's just maybe a bit of calcification, or you know how you get into denial, and doctors are just as capable of doing that, if not more so than ordinary patients. When I eventually went, of course, they said, let's do a mammogram. I said, I do not want to do a mammogram. I don't believe in them. One, you spread cancer by squashing the breast. Number two, it's not very accurate. Thermography is far more accurate, and mammography should be taken off the table for breast cancer because it causes its radiation in and of itself. It's not accurate. All it leads is to more tests, just
So
like
you're
all these
right for screening.
colonoscopies and all
Yeah,
this screening stuff.
the screening is basically useless in medicine, almost
Yes, it
without
is.
qualification. But isn't there a place for mammography in following breast cancer that's already established, the
No,
diagnosis established? No.
there's never a place for it. And what they do is straight after the mammography, which obviously looked like cancer, and I could have told them that, they go to ultrasound, which is what I'd requested. I said, let's just go straight to ultrasound. But of course, all these people, the hospitals, the insurance company, all of them making money, you charging for the mammography, charging for the ultrasound. Then, of course, they frightened me and said, you've got to have a skin, you've got to have a biopsy, you've got to have a biopsy. And fool that I was, I allowed them to pierce the capsule, and per square centimeter of cancer, there's probably 1 billion cancer cells. And then, of course, they do the biopsy, they charge for that pathology because you can't get any surgery done without it. And by the time I was put on the schedule for surgery, I elected just to do bilateral mastectomy because I didn't want to deal with MRIs and things constantly and fear that it would come back. Yes, there were a couple of lymph nodes involved, not a lot, but it was the skin biopsy that did, it was the cancer biopsy that did it. I say to people, never ever do these biopsies. Try the cryo first if it's a solid tumor. And I mean, obviously, like
So the
anything,
cryo is liquid nitrogen. Do they insert it into the below the skin, or do they just freeze it from the surface?
No, they go into the tumor.
And they use some sort of wand or something that in which
needle,
liquid
yes.
needle
Correct.
Which the do yes. they inject the liquid nitrogen into the tumor, or do they just put the wand near the tumor and freeze it?
No, they go into it and they freeze the whole thing. But I've actually used cryotherapy in chronic pain medicine to treat certain neuromas and other things like that. You can use it on almost any nerve, and it's absolutely amazing in terms of pain relief. But it, particularly with cancer, it doesn't cause spread, and it freezes everything, and then the cells die off, the body clears it out. And virtually non-invasive, I mean, it's invasive that there's a needle going in your skin, but you're not doing this traumatic major surgery of any kind. But again, it depends on the size, obviously, of the tumor and whether you already have metastatic spread. But there's even papers showing that cryotherapy, which is typically done by interventional radiology or certain breast surgeons, can, there's a something called the Ascopal effect, where when you treat the primary tumor, even if you have metastases, it can stop, it can make those other metastases go away. And it probably has to do with signaling from the stem cells and those kind of things. So anyway, I didn't do that. I elected to have a major surgery. And then, of course, the oncologist said, well, you're stage two. You need to have chemotherapy and radiation and tamoxifen. And I said, no, tamoxifen is a cancer-causing agent, just like nine of the most common chemo drugs are actually listed by the World Health Organization as causing cancer. They're type 1A carcinogens, which doesn't mean they may or possibly cause cancer. There's some study. No, they actually cause cancer. And it says it right on the package insert.
Just to interject, there aren't that many things that are determined to be carcinogens. There might be 80 or less. And it's not just that anything can be a carcinogen. It's that there are specific agents which have been determined conclusively to induce cancer.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Determined to conclusively enjoy cancer and induce cancer, which is what tamoxifen does. It can induce uterine cancer. And the oncologist will say, yes, when you're on tamoxifen, we have to monitor you for uterine cancer, never mind all the blood clots and risk of stroke and heart attacks and all those things. And it was
tamoxifen is an estrogen blocker. So you lose the protection of the estrogen on the rest of your physiology, which, yeah.
Correct.
Right? Yeah.
Correct. You're attacking all the estrogen, and there's three or four different types. You know far more about this than me. There's only one type of estrogen, I believe it's the estrone, that is the one that can lead to signaling and promulgation of cancer. So it doesn't make sense. Like I used something called DIM, diindolmethylsulfane, which is actually from sulfurans that you get from foods like cabbage and Brussels sprouts and things like this. And it's been shown to actually promote good estrogen but block bad estrogen. But if I had had the chemotherapy, I already knew at that point there was no way I was doing radiation or chemo. Didn't believe in it for my type of cancer.
Good for you. Yeah.
Yeah. But if I had, I actually developed a post-surgical infection with a very unusual bacterium. It was Mycobacterium chelonii. The infectious disease doctor said they only see one a year. Typical, the doctor is the one who gets it, right? It's always when you treat a doctor or a nurse, there's a problem. But anyway, that's what I got.
That's frequently water contamination in the surgery.
Correct.
So
or when you're showering or whatever, I had drainage tubes for a while. So
how long
yes,
did you wait
exactly.
before you showered after the surgery?
He didn't give me any instructions on that. So
yeah. So right
probably,
away. That's the story. You picked it up from your shower.
And
because
even
it's
today, that's
ubiquitous.
what he said.
So about
That's
half
what
of
he
water
said.
sources have that stuff. I know about it because I had that surgical complication and I had to study it when I was in practice.
That's ironic.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it's very severe.
So you
And
took a couple drugs, you took
antibiotics for 6 months.
yeah, it's crazy.
The Cipro, I had to stop, ciprofloxacin, I had to stop after a month because I developed such severe myositis
Oh.
and tendinopathy
Cipro
that
is a
I
nightmare drug.
could, yeah, I could
Yeah.
barely walk. And do you know when I said to the infectious disease physician, I said, "What about the risk of Achilles tendonitis with ciprofloxacin and all the quinolones, which is well known?" He said, "Oh, that's so rare.
Tendon
I
rupture.
hardly ever see it." And he didn't even tell me that it would affect every tendon and muscle in my body. I could barely stand up or walk or do anything. And I called him after a month. I said, "I'm stopping this drug because it's going to kill me. I
So
cannot stand
there's
anymore."
Bactrim and what are the other, and I think another macrolide or two works for that, right?
Yeah, I forget the drug I was on. It's more of an unusual one.
Anyway, it's not important. Go on with your story.
But anyway, I survived. But I'm telling you, that infection is severe. And if I'd been on chemo with no immune system, I would have been dead. I believe that. So I'm very glad I didn't choose chemo on a number of levels. Plus, when I was in the hospital recovering from surgery, so many of the nurses told me that they'd had breast cancer, had gone the route of tamoxifen, radiation, and chemo, and almost to a woman said that their brains had never recovered. They had the chemo brain. And I just thought, you
It's
know,
at least half. It's 50, it's 30 to
yeah.
50% of people who get chemo have, major
Yeah.
neurological
And I
problems.
still wanted to work as a physician. And I'm like, I cannot afford to have any cognitive dysfunction whatsoever.
Who can?
Who
Right?
can, right? But
Jeez.
particularly for us with, all kinds of our jobs in general. So anyway, I did absolutely wonderfully. I went at that time, I went on a low sugar diet. I'd started doing the mind body thing because you have to do that. There's actual personalities
Let's just
associated
chat
with.
briefly about the no sugar. It is a common thread in alternative cancer treatments, the keto diet, the no sugar diet. Did you go keto or carnivore also or not?
I should have maybe gone carnivore for a while, but I went keto. And then when I became, what's the word, complacent, I started having little slips. I would have a glass of wine or I would have some cake and things like that. But I think other things factored into why the cancer came back. But certainly people don't realize that even as far back, I think as it was 1936, Otto Warburg, who's a Nobel Prize-winning laureate and scientist, talked about the importance of keto diet in cancer because people don't realize that cancer cells can only survive on sugar. They cannot use ketogenesis.
So if you
And
get in ketosis, which means that you're surviving on fat and you're using fat for your brain and all your activity, the sugar just isn't as much a prominent part of the cycle, and it doesn't cause the cancer growth.
correct. In fact, I would say, as a fundamental foundation for anybody dealing with cancer, and it doesn't matter what sort of cancer you have, there's certain things that I think are fundamental. One is if you can exercise a little, you have to for your lymphatic system. Number two is mind, body, spirit. Number three is a keto or carnivore type diet. In other words, a very low carbohydrate, high protein, and high fat, good fat, like avocados and things, not monounsaturated fats and grass-fed animal fats and non-farmed fish and not any fats with seed oils. The only oils people should use are things like grass-fed butter, ghee, coconut oil, and
Animal
macadamia nut
fats.
oil,
Animal
but
fats.
not any of the sunflower, sesame seed, all of these different oils that actually persist in your body for sometimes years, but definitely months, and are highly inflammatory and have excessive amounts of alpha, omega-6 linoleic acids, which are not good for your body. Well, you have a balance of omega-6 and omega-3s, but you certainly don't want to overload your body with omega-6 because of the inflammation. It's similar to what trans fats do. And I think that's also why we're seeing so much cancer as well as other diseases. And it goes to this fantastic book that I read by Dr. Nasha Winters, who is actually, she was a naturopathic physician who's became an integrative oncologist, and she's a cancer survivor. And she wrote a book called The Metabolic Approach to Cancer. And she talks about the 10 variables that are primary drivers of cancer. And sugar is obviously on the list. Things like mitochondrial dysfunction, toxins, your microbiome, your hormones, inflammation, your immune system. So anything that reduces inflammation in your body, like coconut oil and macadamia nut oil, I would have said avocado oil and olive oil, but in this country at least, they are adulterated with seed oils.
So to reiterate, animal fats, which had been reviled by the vegetable food industry, you know, the vegetable fat industry, and had been disdained by the RDA and all these other ridiculous sources that pointed us in the wrong direction. Animal fats are perfectly fine, and most vegetable fats are not as good. And just for the listeners' information, there is a test commercially now that you can order, and I'll include the link in the show notes, of the percent in your body of the good fats versus the bad fats. And you can see how you've been doing with your diet. And again, the animal fats are virtually all fine, except for, you know, the ungulates, the cows and the sheep are safer because they have the multiple stomachs, which can inactivate pesticides and glyphosate, and also seed oils, as I understand it. So you're better off with sheep or beef fat.
I would extrapolate a little further on those comments. You're pretty correct, but I would also say, take the fats that are grass-fed, and because most of these animals that are in corporate run farms are being fed, just like we've been fed, high fructose corn syrup. That whole thing of the USDA food pyramid, in fact, there's been studies showing that the so-called American diabetic diet actually causes the diabetes to get worse, whereas a keto diet makes it better. But part of it was, there were two studies done showing that a high fat diet is better for you. And it makes common sense. We grew up as cavemen and paleo man and all of that, mostly not having any grains and eating plants and fruits in the season and then having lots and lots of meat. And look at the Eskimos, who survive primarily on a high meat diet. It again, that comes into genetics, comes into play.
Very high
but
fat
again,
diet.
You want animals, the animals need to be fed good food, just like we do. And so I would be very careful with the chickens and any sort of meat, whether it's pork, chicken, whether it's pork, beef, lamb. You still want something that has been raised on a family farm, not a corporate farm, that has been fed proper food, preferably clean grass, not corn feed. And this USDA study where the high-fat diet was shown to be, they tossed that aside and developed the USDA food pyramid with grains at the top and then all this high-carb nonsense and high-fructose corn syrup. Very easy to produce, and now they've put it in everything. And of course, they've got 90 different names for it now because they know that most Americans have suddenly realized that high-fructose corn syrup is the devil and they need to stay away from it. But it, ever since high-fructose corn syrup was introduced into America, you can track the rise in obesity, in diabetes, in hypertension, in all these things. So all these things, the seed oils, the high fructose corn syrup, and sugar in any form, highly inflammatory. Plus GMO, anything genetically modified, they ban it in Europe. They don't allow it in the food. Genetically modified foods, I think, have caused tremendous autoimmune dysfunction in
And
America.
inflammatory is the last thing you want if you have cancer. So
Exactly.
go on to the treatments you've had and what you thought has worked and what hasn't worked in your experience with the naturopaths and Tijuana and all that.
Okay, well, let me catch my breath
That's
because
okay.
that's a lot to unpackage. Obviously, I made mistakes. I made mistakes right at the beginning. And the more I've gone on this journey, and it is a bit of a roller coaster, the more you realize how complex it is, what a labyrinth it is to navigate a cancer journey. Because they operate, it's not all the allopathic medicine world that is to blame for the lack of improvement in cancer rates. All these societies and all the NIH and CDC billions that they've thrown at cures for cancer have actually done absolutely nothing to improve cancer rates, and it's massively on the rise. So, but on the naturopathic or holistic side, there are a lot of bad players. And so I initially in 2016, I just did a detoxification regime. I cut out most sugar and I exercised and I went for counseling because breast cancer patients often have a lot of anger. They've done studies on it. You have to clear that. In fact, there's no human being alive who doesn't have some kind of PTSD from childhood, usually other things. And obviously, there's levels, but there's also a whole level of anxiety disorders that lead up to PTSD. And I believe depression is a form of anxiety disorder. So you have to deal with anxiety from whatever reason. And nobody has got through life unscathed in that regard. And so learning to calm yourself, and it goes to stress as a huge, huge factor in diseases, especially cancer. You've got to try and reduce stress in your life. So I detoxed, I did some counseling. I tried to reduce stress in my life, but of course I went back to work, and I went back to work a little too soon, but that's what doctors do. We drive ourselves to the point of exhaustion. And then I took certain supplements like DIM. I took high dose vitamin D because people's vitamin D levels are very low in general.
What are your D
And
levels now?
they're around 80, 90.
Mine are
And that's what,
130.
wow. Well, a lot of naturopaths try and keep people between 70 to 100. Certainly, the normal range, so-called normal in Western medicine, is 35 to 40 nanograms per ml. But vitamin D is so extraordinary in terms of your immune system. It really is like the universal hormone slash vitamin because it acts as a hormone, as you know. They've found studies that if you have a good vitamin D level, you're much less prone to get colds or influenza or those kind of things. So it's essential. Same as correcting thyroid dysfunction seems to be very prevalent in a lot of cancers, and especially in breast cancer, iodine deficiency has been found to be a big factor. And people don't realize that iodine actually plays a role not just in supporting your thyroid function, but in detoxification, even of things like heavy metals and radiation, obviously. And I started something called natokinase, which is a natural anticoagulant. It's actually an enzyme. And I know it's on the long COVID and vaccine injury protocols too. But what it does is it's a natural anticoagulant. And that's really important in most cancers because most people with any kind of cancer are more prone to get blood clots. I did not want to be on blood thinners, even aspirin. I just am very cautious with anything pharmaceutical that could affect my immune system because immune system, nutrition, and as I say, your mind, body, are very the mind-body connection and developing some spiritual connectedness to a higher power are important. And I'm not talking any specific religion. I'm just saying you have to have faith in life and in hope.
Did you try any of the emotional freedom techniques or the tapping or any of that?
Yes.
And you found that useful?
It's very useful. Very, very useful. One of the people I respect the most, she's done work. Her name's Laurie Lydon. She was my counselor. She's done work with Project Light and has worked with children in Rwanda who arguably have some of the worst PTSD in the world. They've seen their parents literally chopped up in front of their eyes, and some of them have had their arms cut off and things like this, endured unbelievable horrors. She used tapping, and then what she calls the grace method, and that's more complex. In the latter 7 years of my career, had started doing stellate ganglion blocks for PTSD, which reset your sympathetic nervous system. And
where is the stellate ganglion? Explain to the listeners
It's part of your sympathetic fight and flight system.
And it's where is
and
it?
And it's located in your neck. So you have a lumbar sympathetic plexus and a thoracic, and then you have a pelvic sympathetic. So it runs the entire length.
How long a needle did you need to get into it?
Depends on the patient's neck. Some people have bull necks, right?
Yeah.
You have to
inches long.
The standard is ultrasound.
Did you use sclerosants or what did you use for the block?
Oh, absolutely not. No, just local anesthetic.
And the local anesthetic had longer term effects?
Yes, more than just the few hours that normally. Yeah, yeah. Because what you're doing when you inject it is if the sympathetic system, and I believe all anxiety disorders are sympathetic system hyperactivation. And actually Gabor Mate, who's a world famous psychiatrist and addictionologist, essentially says the same thing. He's written a book called The Myth of Normal, which says that most diseases are driven by these things. And he's also one who doesn't believe in depression. And that's why these antidepressants that Big Pharma push on us, besides their fraudulent research, which actually never proved that they did anything and they actually harm people.
No placebo really controls on any of it. No psych drugs ever had a placebo controlled trial. So they're ridiculous.
They're numb
racketeering.
People. Yeah. Yeah. And they just numb people. And then people lose even more connectedness with life and their loved ones. So, but anyway, he says, I believe having done 7 years of very successful treatments, and I had my own proprietary paradigm, which is different to the people out there that are trying to just make lots of money from it. I realize that almost all anxiety disorders have a level of sympathetic hyperactivation. So when I inject the local, it would reset it from whatever level it was at to kind of normal resting phase. But
so you use the EFT, the emotional freedom technique.
I have
underscore
no training
that.
In that. But yeah. I did tapping.
Yeah,
and
tapping
is
an emotional freedom technique. Supposedly they tap on 15 different places on your head and your body. You just tap with your fingers and it's as simple as that.
You're reciting certain things.
Mantras or something.
But it's very powerful. I have a number of friends who are either counselors, psychologists, or psychiatrists. So I've learned a lot from them, and I learned a lot from my work in PTSD. But people have to learn to control anxiety, because the cancer diagnosis in and of itself induces dramatic anxiety, not only in the patient, but in all their loved ones too. So the loved ones can benefit from learning to be a little calmer and making decisions more calmly. I was put in a panic state by the medical profession and made bad decisions as a result, instead of taking my time.
Well, you avoided the chemo and the radiation, which is the biggest decision of all. So I wouldn't say you made horrible decisions. And, you know,
yeah, I just wish I'd never done the major surgery. But anyway, down the line, I did extremely well and flourished for many years until 2022, when all of a sudden I started coughing and having a hard time breathing. And again, I thought it was just asthma coming back or something in the environment. and treated myself with antibiotics and prednisone and inhalers until it kept, it improved a little, but it didn't go away. And eventually went and got a chest x-ray, which showed a large pleural effusion in my left lung.
Which is fluid in between the lung substance and the chest wall. And
correct.
Yeah, it probably was a liter or something, that much fluid, wasn't it? Did they
it was
tap
about
it?
2 liters,
Two
actually.
liters.
And so it was full of cancer cells.
Jeez.
And I had a node in my lung, in the upper part of my right lung. I had some cancer in lymph nodes in both armpits as well. Yeah, luckily nothing else anywhere else in my body. So I started, I knew again I did not want to do any cancer drugs. So I immediately started again a detoxification, wasted a lot of money on very expensive urine, because I do believe that a lot of supplements are actually bad for you, and they're oversold and overhyped, and they're not really the answer. I did really get strict with my diet, because I, as I said, I'd become a little lax over the preceding years, as I seem to be doing well. So really cut down on carbohydrates, not just sugar, and started eating more protein, avoiding things even like bread or pasta, white rice. And I thought about doing the juicing, and I know a lot of people recommend that, and there's a place for it, but you've got to be careful with juicing, because juicing can give you high sugar content as well. And I went for hyperbaric treatments, which were absolutely amazing, and also actually helped reduce the fluid. So it would give me a little bit of time in between.
How many hyperbaric treatments did you have?
Oh my goodness. I probably landed up doing, because in that year I was doing hyperbaric every week. So probably 20, 30.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I also did some in 2023 when I went to a clinic in Mexico for 3 weeks of kind of holistic treatment there. Almost all the integrative oncology centers will offer hyperbaric oxygen, because cancer cells hate oxygen. And that then correlates with another point I want to make about many cancers, is that there's much research and wonderful webinars you can look at that talk about the correlation between parasites and fungus in cancer generation. And so that's why what I'm going to talk about next factors in. So a friend of mine got me a consultation with a well-known cancer doctor in Brazil who gets very good results. She put me on high-dose ivermectin in...
How much? 140 milligrams a day, I heard.
Something like that.
Yeah, yep. Yeah.
Plus a bunch of other supplements, which
you didn't
I don't
get
know
the
that
fenbendazole at that point.
No, I did not. But what was interesting is I was having a pleural tap every 2 weeks, and each time getting out between 1.5 to 2 liters from my right lung.
Okay, in other words, a large needle was stuck in her back to suck out the fluid in between her lung space and the chest wall, and a full quart or two was taken out every time. It's a horrible thing to get done every week. You breathe better.
Or every 2 weeks.
Or every 2 weeks.
Yeah, it feels fantastic once they do it. But there's about a minute or two where the pain is absolutely horrendous. I'm not a screamer type person, but I would actually scream for...
They couldn't use enough local to make it work.
Well, they have to inject the local.
Yeah.
But it's as they're injecting the local and they're touching the pleura. The pleura is incredibly sensitive.
Yeah.
That's
this
what
is
hurts.
Unskillful. I think if a skillful tapper can get the stuff out without any pain. In other words, you infiltrate the whole area, pump in the local on top of the pleura, and then you don't feel it. But so you
what
had
I've
someone.
Found. I found some people, and I ended up saying to them, look, I want at least 10 cc's of local, and I want you to wait.
Yeah, exactly. You wait a half an hour, and you can use 30
half
cc's
an hour,
and more
two
dilute.
Or 3 minutes. And then I didn't feel a thing. And so The last few taps that I've had, I've barely felt anything.
Yeah.
But at that time, it was bad. So the hyperbaric was not only good for my cancer, it was also good for, because it reduced the fluid, it would drive fluid into, out of the pleura. And so that would give me relief. I could breathe. And also meant
so
that I
the
didn't have to go every
tumors
week.
Hate sugar and they love hyperbaric. They love oxygen.
They love
it. I mean, I got it mixed up. They hate.
No, they hate both.
Yeah, they
hate
hate both.
Sugar. They hate oxygen.
You
and
can
then I
find
also
hyperbaric
started.
Therapy treatment in almost every urban area for around $250 a treatment, or maybe even less if you buy a package. So this is approachable for most people who are listening.
Hyperbaric oxygen is incredible for many things, obviously wound healing, anything neurological. In fact, many of the PTSD patients I treated, their PTSD had also resulted in traumatic brain injury. I'm talking about veterans being blown up and things like this. And so, or people in car accidents. And I saw tremendous improvements in their memory and their cognition with the hyperbaric. It truly is a miracle, and I would highly recommend it to anybody who has cancer or any neurological problem, whether it be Parkinson's or strokes or whatever. The other thing that I started about that time was something called PEMF, and I bought my own machine, and I still do it. It's called pulsed electromagnetic frequency, and it
how much
has
did the machine cost?
The machine cost me about $5,000. It's quite small. It's very easy to use. I bought mine through a company called MagnaWave.
And it's some sort of vibrational therapy. Is that correct?
It's an electromagnetic therapy. It's very interesting. It's been around more than a century. So it actually has a long history of treatment for pain. In animals, it's amazing. They use it in horses and dogs because they have no resistance to energy and achieves, I mean, if anybody has an animal in pain or they're in pain, they should try it. But it was FDA approved, I think back in 1976, for bone healing of fractures because it improves circulation. It helps with as an antioxidant. I wrote down a few things. It
it's
stimulates
okay.
your immune system. It optimizes cellular function, relieves stress, improves sleep, boosts energy, increases oxygen.
This is a microcurrent
and
machine.
ATP
Microcurrent,
production.
is that how you characterize it? Microcurrent?
It's primarily magnetic field energy being applied to your body. And as you know, the Earth has magnetism. In fact, the Earth's magnetism is reduced by 50%, apparently, in the last 300 years, according to NASA. And we don't get a lot of influence from the Earth's magnetism because we're always wearing shoes. And that goes to the grounding thing. And that's why people often walking on a beach will feel so good, or when in nature, barefoot. But it works on all of those. And magnetism, our bodies are electromagnetic energy. Our cells, positive and negative ions, right? Our cells are light and magnetism and electricity. So it makes sense that some of those modalities would work, like some of the amazing suggestions that Nikola Tesla had that were suppressed, that potentially are breakthroughs in healthcare and medicine. But again, they were suppressed, much like what his clean energy approaches were suppressed by big oil. They did not want those technologies to get out because that doesn't make anybody much money.
Katrina, tell the story about the clinic that you went to in Tijuana that was not so good. Just as many specifics as you can, except for the names.
Okay,
and the problems you feel with the alternative medicine people.
Okay, just because it correlates with the previous story that I was retelling, is that, so I started the ivermectin and some other stuff in July of 2022. By October 2022, there was no more fluid being produced in my right lung. My oncologist's notes even said, surprisingly, Dr. Lewis is not having any more pleural effusion. She didn't know what to make of it, but she was kind of interested in what I was doing. So I carried on with the high dose ivermectin, but I think that dose was a little too high. And I even if you take vitamin A, because the ivermectin will affect you if you have vitamin A deficiency, beta carotene. I was taking some, but she said if you start getting sort of eye flashes or feeling kind of like you're looking at the world in a strange way, then you probably need to reduce the dose. So I was getting those symptoms. And again, I also thought, my gosh, how's my liver handling this high of a dose? And stupidly, because I hadn't bothered to do much research, I was dealing with a whole lot of other things. Because around that time, I decided, what am I doing staying working when I have stage four cancer? This doesn't make sense. I need to go and relieve stress, take care of myself, and retire and go on disability. So that's what I did. So after December of 2022, I stupidly started tapering the ivermectin because I didn't really know what was working. I thought it was a combination. I didn't really recognize its significance. But, and I was doing so well. And I moved from Montana to Florida. But in June of 2023, I started noticing that I was getting more short of breath.
So
And when I
you
went,
taper the dose to what? Yeah, in other words, she decreased
oh,
the dose.
I
And
decreased it to
just
30
for
milligrams
reference,
twice a week.
oh my goodness, that's not much. For reference, the standard COVID dose might be 15 to 30 milligrams a day, right?
Correct. They usually recommend 0.2 milligrams per kilogram. If you're taking it for parasite infections or even for COVID, is my
Yeah.
understanding.
And this
Yeah, on
stuff is.
FLCCC's website,
Yeah.
I think that's what they list. Yeah.
It's regarded as virtually harmless. There's perhaps never been an overdose. There's billions of doses administered. And so, if I had to bet on a drug being safe for larger doses, I'd bet on ivermectin.
Correct. It's been listed for decades on the World Health Organization's list of top 10 most essential drugs in the world. It has a safety record going back 70 years. It won the Nobel Prize for its developer because it's such an incredible drug. And we keep finding out more and more how incredible of a drug it is. I actually read an article the other day showing that it actually has not just nine, but potentially 15 mechanisms of action against cancer. And it is extremely safe. So anyway, I went to this clinic in Tijuana and thinking I will just do an intense 3-week thing of everything: hypothermia, hyperbaric, PEMF, infusions of Laetrile, infusions of vitamin C, all these things that I couldn't really do altogether by myself.
Laetrile apparently does have double-blind placebo-controlled studies for some solid tumors already. So that's a pretty
Correct.
effective thing
Yeah.
intravenously. Anyway, sorry to interject there. So you went
No,
to
that's quite
this
all right.
clinic, and what did you find? And how much they charge you for 3 weeks?
They charged me about $53,000. And I came to find that a woman with metastatic breast cancer, also metastatic in her lungs, but far more extensive than mine, they only charged her $40.
They 40,000. So they get what they can. That's what you're saying.
Oh, and they were constantly trying to upcharge
Upsell.
and upsell. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I found out, obviously, I think they didn't approach me because they knew I was a physician. I think they were nervous that I would see right through that. They were offering patients stem cell therapy, IV, for $10,000
10,000.
a pop.
Yeah. Where
And
was it? Fat
even
derived?
I think the quality of their Laetrile, the quality of their hypothermia, they were using the cheapest
Oh,
formulations.
hang on. It's mistletoe that has the good trials. I don't know about
Yes,
Laetrile.
mistletoe is wonderful. I did mistletoe injections for a very, very long time, until they stopped working. You're meant to get a wheel, but it stopped giving me a wheel. And then I went higher and higher and higher. And then I stopped it. So they were offering the mistletoe, and that's partly what I did want. And there's different kinds of mistletoe
No
for breast
doubt.
cancer. Yeah.
So
So
you
some
spent
work
3 weeks
better than
there
others.
and you gradually started to smell a rat because of the marketing, internal marketing.
Well, I realized I wasn't getting any better. And at the end of it, they did a ultrasound, because they do an ultrasound and this full examination of you, of the size of your tumor and all of this. And mine had actually not changed at all. In fact, it was slightly bigger, and I'd started developing fluid in my left lung, and that was slightly bigger, the amount of fluid. And then I was also talking to other people. They had a client there who was from Australia, and I think she's like a social media influencer. And I suspect now they were paying her. She claimed she was completely cured of stage four all over her body.
Breast
And was,
cancer.
I think so.
Yeah.
And she claimed that she went 5 years. It totally took it all away.
So,
And then she comes back for treatments every 6 months, or her cancer just came back. But there were a lot of Australians and New Zealanders there who'd been influenced by her to come and get treatment. And when I met her, was like, wow, this is amazing. And I got so excited. But of all the patients I spoke to who joined at the 3 months, the 3 week beginning of the 3 week period that I joined, I only know of one who noticed a reduction in his prostate cancer size. And his was very minor to start off with. But everybody else had actually either not improved at all, or my friend is actually way worse.
So Dr. Katrina is underscoring the fact that you have to make your own decisions. You cannot trust everyone just because they say they're a naturopath or a homeopath, and that a lot of these cancer treaters are opportunistic. So that's the message here. You've got to do your research and know what you're getting.
Well, even when you do your research, and this is the point, again, where humility comes in, a lot of these cancer places in Mexico, there is one that I think is very good. It's
What's
called
that?
Sanaviv,
S O S A.
Sanovivi. And my naturopath recommended it. And he's seen patients who were told they only had a few months to live, who are now alive years later. But if you look at their website, for one thing, when you get to their clinic, they make you take all your clothing off, and they give you cotton, organic cotton to wear. And the whole, it's a hospital, but it has a spa, it has swimming pools, it has everything. It's in Tijuana.
How
So you
long did you
find,
spend over there?
I didn't go there, but it's in my back pocket. If I start regressing, I'm going to go there. But
Who else do you
they,
consider credible for cancer treatment besides Sanaviv?
in Mexico?
Anywhere. Who are your top five?
I don't have a top five, because what I learned with the place that I made the mistake for, they had a medical director, like all of them. They often have medical directors who've written a book. They have webinars. They have this fantastic looking website. You can do all the research you want, but unless you've personally gone there or know somebody who's gone to some of them, you can be misled. So I can recommend Sanaviv and Paracelsus Clinic
What's
in
that
Switzerland.
in Switzerland? How do you spell that?
Paracelsus.
Okay.
Although I believe they've pulled back from doing some of the cancer treatment, and they focus more on other diseases and things like Lyme disease and all of that. And there are people like Thomas Lodi or Dr. Paul Anderson in the US, Schallenberger. Obviously, they're much more expensive, but they're doing some solid work. And I've seen good results with these people in patients I've spoken to personally, or personal friends. But again, they're not the be all and end all. And what I say I did for me, I wouldn't necessarily say somebody else should do. So if I th that's why I'm so pleased and honored, and also grateful that you've given me a chance to talk on your platform, because for patients who don't have the kind of medical knowledge I have, so I'm not just an MD, but I had this whole holistic background
Yeah.
and I made these huge mistakes. So for the average layperson, how
It's
would they?
impossible. It's impossible.
Impossible.
It's
Yeah.
impossible to navigate any of the medical system very successfully unless you have someone who's who knows what's happening and also is healthcare on your side as an advocate. It's tough.
So when I came back from this particular clinic in Mexico, within a week or so, I nearly died because the fluid had built up in my good lung and I hadn't realized it. I thought it was just asthma, and the hotel that they put us in was supposedly this five-star hotel, but they were spraying fragrance and chemicals. And it's interesting, at that hotel, I kept asking for organic food with no MSG. And they go, oh, no, we send all our organic food to America. We can't give you organic food. And everything had MSG in it. In other words, everything was out of a bottle.
Towers. The hotel is a two-tower thing near the border, correct?
No, the name I'm talking about Cancun.
Oh, Cancun. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah. And as I said, I checked with a few hotels. I'm like, can your chef not do a reduction sauce with just some fresh oranges and you know, wine or whatever, instead of stuff out of a bottle? Because if you're telling me there's MSG in every sauce in your hotel, you're obviously using sauces out of a bottle. And I was shocked. And I mean, these are high-end hotels where you're paying a lot of money, and they could not guarantee MSG-free, which blew my mind. But anyway, within a short time after coming back from there, the fluid had built up so badly that I landed up in hospital. And that's when I went back over what I'd done, and I knew the fluid had stopped in 2022, and started reading more. And I'm like, I have got to go back on ivermectin.
Which you can get from India. Anyone can order it.
Correct.
And we'll put one of the sources in the show notes
I've
ordered.
Well, and there's also a lot of great compounding pharmacies.
If you get a prescription from a local physician.
Yeah. Right. And they're very good compounding pharmacies. In fact,
Who do you recommend? Who do you like?
I like Evergreen in Montana.
Okay.
I like West Coco Compounding and Pharmacy. They're a full pharmacy, but they do compounding.
Where are they?
And they are here in Florida.
Okay.
And is there one? There was one other place. I can't think of it right now. I keep a supply.
Sure.
From different places, just to be sure.
How big are your ivermectin? How many milligrams are each capsule? Because the only ones I've seen are like 10 milligrams.
Well, I've been taking since September the 100 milligrams. And so the highest the one pharmacy can go is 75. And everyone's a little different. Evergreen, I think the highest they go is a 29.5. But they're small capsules. And this is what I say to patients. You always want small capsules or powder or homeopathics or liposomal, which is a type of liquid that's very bioavailable. If you can possibly avoid tablets, you should, because tablets are solid with congeners, which are substances to make them solid, which can be toxic. And also they often don't break down, especially in older people, because our enzyme systems in our liver and all of these things are not as good. So tablets, you very seldom absorb much of it. It's very seldom bioavailable. So that's what I've been doing. And the fenbendazole, which I do.
So who put you onto the fenbendazole?
I started watching a webinar from a Chinese gentleman, because I was really researching the link between parasitic infections and fungal infections in cancer. And there were different protocols. You could use mebendazole, which is also an antiparasitic. The fenbendazole, the FDA only approve it for use in animals in this country.
But you can buy it. You can buy that freely. So there's no problem at all. And as a matter
of
fact,
Fenben Lab. They're out of India. And there's a couple of other places that have the fenbendazole. There's one called, I think it's a form of fenbendazole called Paracure. And
that's the brand. And so that stuff is related to ivermectin, isn't it?
It's an antiparasitic, an antihelminthic, but it has a separate mechanism of action to ivermectin.
So it's unrelated chemically to ivermectin.
Correct. It works on microtubules primarily. And it's part of the, what's called the Joe Tippins protocol. Joe Tippins was a gentleman who had stage 4 cancer and went through chemo and all these things. And then it didn't work, as it usually doesn't. And then he was told he just had a few months to live. So then he went on vitamin E. He went on curcumin, which is one of the few supplements I do take. I take a very bioavailable form. I use one from Life Extension, but there's also one from a company called Therapeutic.
So you don't like Costco.
Integrative Therapeutic.
Costco's curcumin. No.
I haven't
I take
done
Costco's.
It might be okay. I don't know if it's bioavailable or not. And you want to take 500 to 600 twice a day. Curcumin, same as ginger. They've had studies with ginger showing that it's far more effective than most chemo against cancer. So I add ginger juice to, I do a concoction. I use soursop, which is a fruit that has been shown to have very strong anti-cancer activity. Same as bitter melon. And so I do a concoction with purified water. I drink a lot of hydrogenated water. You can buy a hydrogenator off Amazon, a bottle that hydrogenates your pure, and you should be drinking pure water. Use any sort of filter you want.
So the path to Finben or Finbendazole is I think it's finbendazole.com or .org, right? Is that it?
And there's a few different websites. Yeah. I use finben.com, FENBN.com. And they're wonderful.
Tippin has his own website, doesn't he? Or is he published on Substack? There's a whole Substack thing that has all these stories about finbendazole and cancer treatment.
Yep.
Is your
there's lots of studies.
Two capsules, which would be 240 milligrams a day? Is that your dose?
No. His dose originally was 222 milligrams. But I actually take 440.
Take
four, 444. No, it comes as one capsule.
I see.
444 milligram. And I take it 5 days a week. I give my liver a rest. And that's what Tippins did originally. He took fenbendazole 3 days a week and then took a break for 4 days. So you can play around. Like some people say, of the ivermectin, all you need is 34 milligrams a day. Right now, and with the situation I was in last year, I needed to do something urgently to save my lung and stop this fluid forming. So that's why I went onto the 100 milligram dose of ivermectin.
I thought it was 140. 100?
No, that was in 2022.
Yeah, yeah.
I was on 160 a day.
160.
Yeah. But I think you can probably use somewhere between 50 to 100 is probably fine. But it depends on your situation. Again, if your cancer is very severe, or like mine, where you're getting life-threatening fluid in your good lung, and you don't want to be going every single week or having drains put in and things like this, it takes a few months to start working. And I'll say that too. And that's why I'm just going to stay on it right now. My latest PET scan shows no cancer, and my labs look amazing. Cancer markers, everything are way down, and everything else looks pretty stellar. Thank you, universe. Thank you, God. But yes, I probably may go down to just 75, but I'm probably going to stay on these two drugs the rest of my life, or till they start indefinitely.
So you would attribute those two medications plus the possibly a small role for curcumin?
Not a small role. I think the curcumin's fairly important. I think vitamin D is essential, actually. And again, use a bioavailable form of vitamin D, which would be a D3, not a D2, and not a big pharma D, which are usually D2, which is not as well absorbed. I use a vitamin D spray with K2, which actually helps with your bones. I use it as a spray.
You must take magnesium.
10,000.
Magnesium and selenium, they're also activators of vitamin D.
Yes. You've got to be careful with selenium. So I take just one immune support pill that has about 50 micrograms of selenium a day. I do a mushroom MCT oil and a mushroom powder in my coffee, because that's very immune stimulating. It's all about the immune system, right? Part of that, because your mind, your mindset, your positivity affects your immune system as well. But yes, I do. So I do the curcumin. I do some ginger most days. Ginger juice is what I use, but I put ginger powder on certain foods when I cook. I do the vitamin D. I do the DIM. I do homeopathics because, but my homeopathics are not only prescribed by people who have been doing homeopathy for years, and I didn't used to believe in it, but now I actually do have a lot of confidence in it. But they base it off something I do called quantum biofeedback. And I can tell you more about that if you want to. There's only a few practitioners. I'm not talking about neurobiofeedback. I'm talking about quantum. And I would also say to listeners and readers of this Substack, if you're researching, go through a browser like DuckDuckGo. Don't go through Google, because Google,
Yeah,
it's like whether you're
of
looking
course.
at politics or whatever,
It's CIA.
funded by corporations.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they will block, or the first articles you're going to see is saying that all of this stuff is rubbish. And it's what they, people don't realize. The tobacco industry, everybody accepts now that cigarette smoking causes cancer. No, nobody really questions that anymore. Well, they discovered, a doctor discovered that 50 years ago. And it was getting to be such that the tobacco industry got nervous. So they hired an advertising firm and said, what can we do about this? And they said, oh, let's pay some scientists to do research
Yeah,
that
we know the story.
contradicts, yeah, and confuses
Crazy.
people. And that's what exactly what they do with cancer treatments that work with everything in medicine. Oh no, this, the science says this, and then they confuse people. And it's the same with a lot that has gone on with COVID. They produce fake science where they are paying people to produce inaccurate and invalid studies. But the average person has no idea how to read a scientific study and say, oh, you know,
The
they
average
use,
doctor has no idea.
the average
So,
doctor doesn't either. Yeah, exactly.
Katrina, this has been wonderful. Do you have any other last insights about breast cancer therapy for the audience? It sounds like we've settled on ivermectin and fenbendazole as the most avid treatments that we know of. You haven't gotten a chance to have a look at my testosterone, progesterone ideas yet, and I've got references in our show notes for those, but we don't have to
I
get
think
into that.
that's very important, but it's such a huge topic. But in her book, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer, Dr. Nasha Muntz mentions hormones as a huge driver in cancer as well, one of the 10 variables that typically contribute to cancer. So I think that's very important that people read your book, Hormone Secrets, that they look at what you put. But I don't do
Thanks
that
for the
right now.
advertisement.
No, it's all right. It's not an
Yeah.
advertisement. It's, I believe in it. I just, I'm, it's what I say. I'm telling people about what worked for me. I think the basics, everyone has to find their own journey based on their own genetics and what medications they're on and so many things. But I would say to people, you have to get rid of stress, get your mind calm and positive. You have to do some kind of exercise if you can. Even gentle exercise, you must do ivermectin and fenbendazole. You must do vitamin D for sure. And then you've got to cut out sugar in your diet and all carbohydrates. Don't do too many fruits, especially if you're going to do fruits, do mostly berries. Those are a lower glycemic index. If you're going to do veggies, don't eat a ton of beetroot and carrot and potatoes. Things like that. And if you're going to do keto, go to the really good fats, grass-fed, fish that is not farmed. Farm fish is probably one of the most toxic things you can possibly eat. Chickens that have been free range, not being fed cornmeal and locked in cages with all sorts of so-called vaccines and antibiotics being thrown at them. And just eat from God's bounty on this earth, right? Natural. And don't eat processed foods. If it's got chemicals in it, stay away.
That's easier said than done, isn't it? You look
In
in the
this
average
country, it is. In this country,
supermarket
it
and it
is.
doesn't look so good. Katrina, I'm grateful for your time. Any last information, or do you have a website or anything? You're just a private individual, aren't you?
Just a
Trying to make your
private,
way through the.
humble individual.
And
Trying to thrive.
the smartest guy in this room, as my listeners can see. Well, I'm grateful for your time, and we'll be in touch.
Yes, thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you.
Thank you.